It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we go to the most notorious city in France. Think The French Connection, fashion iconoclasts, edgy filmmakers, and the most exotic menus in the entire country. I'm talking about the mother of all seaports, Marseille. Our guide is Daniel Young, author of Made in Marseille. For contrast, the Sterns are having a proper ladies' lunch at the Wenham Tea House in Wenham, Mass. Then it's the homey Art of the Pot Roast with Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby. Fruit expert David Karp unveils the innocent almond's sinister sister. And we hear about picking your way through the minefield of being a snack mom. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wind me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be you me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid love me, best way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry. Slowly. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap, when I say do it. Send out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's Marseille, the most notorious city in France. Think edgy filmmakers and bouillabaisse, fashion iconoclasts, and the most exotic culinary mix in the country. Our guide is Daniel Young, author of Made in Marseille. Back home, John Willoughby of Gourmet Magazine brings us the art of the pot roast. Fruit expert David Karp reveals the bad girl sister of the innocent almond. Then a political reporter tells of her trickiest assignment, being snack mom for her preschooler. An artist turns to the dinner plate to work out a confounding issue. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column for Gourmet Magazine.
You know, Lynn, next to big, hearty, truck-stop meals of meatloaf and mashed potatoes, one of our favorite things to find when we travel is a good old-fashioned tea room that serves dainty ladies' lunch.
My husband loves being the only 6'2" guy dressed in a cowboy shirt and rodeo belt sitting in a tea room with blue-haired old ladies having hot milk sponge cake. I don't know where he got this mania.
I'm in touch with my female side.
Your old lady, geriatric old lady side. But if there is a tea room within any, 50-mile radius of where we're traveling, we have to go to it. And the Wenham Tea House, as it's actually called, in Wenham, Massachusetts, is really the last of a dying breed. I mean, it's where genteel ladies would lunch on little jello salads and crab cakes and quiche. And then you would go to the adjoining store and you would buy handmade children's clothing and hand-knit items. And it's charming. I mean, Michael looks like a big bull in a china shop there, but he likes it.
Well, and like so many of these the few tea rooms that there are, this is operated as a kind of charitable activity. The profits go to help needy ladies of the community, and they sell their handwork in the shop there and therefore, can make a living doing it.
Are some of these ladies actually doing the cooking?
Yes, they are. And, this is food clearly made by people, by really good cooks. The kind of secret thing about this place is that not only are the dainty ladies' meals wonderful, like the lobster bisque is delicious and the little muffins are wonderful and the tiny little biscuits are great, but you actually can get a great square meal there. I remember we had the most delicious turkey with all the trimmings. It was like a Thanksgiving meal, and it was a hearty meal, too. I mean, a well-balanced one, no doubt about it, but a hearty meal of turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, vegetables, cranberry relish, and hot milk sponge cake for dessert. I didn't leave hungry.
Oh, I know where this comes from, Michael. Didn't you tell me your old Aunt Liz used to take you out to the Indian Trail tea room for lunch back in Winnetka, Illinois?
Yes, I grew up on a tea room, yes.
Okay, so that was probably where it comes from.
Some people grew up on a farm or a ranch. I grew up on a tea room.
Only you, Michael. Do they actually serve tea in the tea room?
They do. They have tea service in the afternoon. The only meals served at the Wenham Tea House are lunch and tea. Tea, I think it goes from like maybe 3 to 5 in the afternoon. They have little canapes and little cakes and cookies that you can have with your tea.
And a wonderful, discreet, dainty sign saying no cell phones, please.
I love it.
What does the place look like?
Charming, charming, charming. It's a beautiful old house. I think it was probably built in the 1700s or 1800s.
Well, the tea room itself goes back to 1916, and it's been there for that long.
This is a very pretty part of Massachusetts, very beautiful old colonial homes. I think this is right near the Myopia Hunt, polo club.
It is. We watched a few polo matches after having lunch at the tea house.
So it's a very kind of, you know, well-heeled community. And the tea room is just charming and dainty. And, you know, boy, I mean, who opens a tea room these days? I mean, it's just something that is, there aren't a lot of, and they should be visited if you're near one.
Sounds good. Hey, thanks, guys.
All right.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, you hear them here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of tea houses, I've got a rookie's guide to brewing a proper cup of tea. This comes from our tea maven, Bill Waddington. Now, you've probably heard different kinds of tea are brewed in different ways. Now, I know, life is complicated enough, and now you want me to remember all this tea stuff. Well, here's the easy guide. First, I want to give you some essential background. Teas go from green, which is not fermented, to oolong, which is usually semi-fermented, to black tea, which is fully fermented. Now, here's the brewing guide. The darker the tea, the hotter the water, and the longer the steep. Green tea needs water at about 158 to 200 degrees. Now, that is off the boil for several moments. Steep, 2 to 3 minutes. Oolongs generally need water between 160 and 190, off the boil for just a few moments. Steep, 4 minutes. Black teas need water just off the boil, with steeping for 5 to 6 minutes. Again, the easy rule, the darker the tea, the hotter the water, and the longer it brews. John Willoughby wears more hats than most food pros. He is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. He's an award-winning food writer and co-author with his pal Chris Slazinger of a clutch of books on grilling and meat. And John still cooks all the time. Hey, John, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
Now, you're our technique guru, and this is pot roast season.
So, is it ever?
Isn't it? So can you do pot roast for me? How do you like to do it? What do we need to know about it?
Well, the great thing about pot roast is, well, there's a lot of great things about it. For one thing, it is about the most homey a meal that there is, so it's really perfect for this particular time. And the other thing is, it's very hard to ruin a pot roast. You can do better pot roasts or worse pot roasts, but it's very hard to ruin it, because basically what a pot roast is a big hunk of braised beef. And braising is a great technique because it is so easy. Basically, braising means you cook something in a covered pot with some liquid that comes about halfway up the side of whatever you're cooking. And it's used to take really tough, gnarly pieces of meat and turn them into really delicious, meltingly tender pieces of meat. So it also has the advantage that you're using the cheaper cuts of meat, which is also, again, another great thing. What happens when you take a piece of meat and braise it is that it takes the collagen, which is a very tough connective tissue in the meat, mm-hmm. and over the period of time with this slow, moist heat, it turns it into gelatin, which is just as smooth and tender and delicious as it sounds. And our friend Hal McGee once did an experiment. He took a rump roast and he roasted it, and he found that 14% of the collagen, those tough connective tissues, had been dissolved into gelatin. Then he took the same cut of meat and he braised it, and 52% of the collagen was turned into this smooth, tender gelatin. So it is a great way to take something that doesn't seem very attractive and make it really delicious.
So I'm so glad Harold McGee does this work.
Isn't it wonderful?
which cuts should you be using for pot roast?
Well, what you want for a pot roast is basically a cut. Most of the best cuts are from the shoulder. So anything that has shoulder in it, there are a lot of different ways that you can cut it depending on the that you're in that part of the country. But anything that says shoulder in it is going to be great. My particular favorite from the shoulder is a 7-blade roast. It just seems to have a perfect combination of fat and collagen, and so that over the period of slow, long cooking, it really breaks down the best, and I think it has the best flavor. But anything from the shoulder or from the leg, which is basically the same thing, is good. Also, you can use rump roast. Most of the round cuts are a little too tough, but the rough rump roast really works great. Mm-hmm. And also brisket makes a great pot roast.
Ah.
So you have a lot of options. Basically, you're just looking for something that's kind of tough and gnarly.
Yeah, and another word for shoulder in the steer world is chuck, right?
Chuck, exactly.
Yeah, for chuck is in the name. Well, there are two schools in the pot roast world. One is the school that says you must brown the meat before you add the liquid, and the other one says you don't have to. Which school do you belong to?
I belong to the browning the meat school. I think it really, one of the disadvantages of braising, just about the only disadvantage, is that you don't brown the meat. And I think brown meat adds a lot of flavor. So even what I like to do is brown it really well at the very beginning, take the meat out of the pot, saute all the seasonings and so on, and put it back in along with the liquid. It doesn't take much longer, about 10 minutes longer, and you really get a lot more flavor.
Okay. Now, what about seasonings?
Well, I think, you know, it's good actually to stray a little bit from the usual. I mean, the classic Yankee pot roast with root vegetables is really good. But I like to use something a little sharper, a little kind of tart flavoring, which I think goes really well with the richness of the roast. So, for example, I like to make a pot roast using balsamic vinegar in the liquid and then put some tomatoes and lemons in it. So you get three kind of acidic ingredients that work against the richness of the roast. My particular favorite pot roast is actually one of my grandmother's recipes, uses caraway seeds and green apples, which sounds a little weird, but it turns out great. The green apples, again, give it a little acidity that works against the richness of the roast. You can, for example, do brisket as a pot roast with sauerkraut. Again, gives you a little bit of the tartness. I think anything that has some of that tartness or acidic flavor really works well. And you can do Asian-style pot roasts. So you use a little lime juice, a little tamarind, and a couple of red chilies, not too much. And then when it's all done, I like to stir a little coconut milk into the braising liquid, which gives it that nice creamy sweetness, which really adds a nice touch.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. You know, I always think of pot roast, because you can be so free and easy with it, as being,
exactly,
you know, as being the kind of thing that you can take all those little jars in the fridge that you have of condiments.
That's right. All those little condiments that you've used like one tablespoon of and you don't know what to do with, this is the place to use them. They are great on pot roast. But again, anything with a strong flavor is nicely counteracted by the richness of the meat. So take your tapenade, use that. You know, if you've got a little chili garlic paste from Asia that you haven't used much of, put that out in a dish and people can put a little on the pot roast. Pot roast will take a lot of flavors.
That's great. And it also takes mustards. I'd forgotten about that. Great mustards.
Mustards are great.
And sandwiches. Hey, John, we're going to eat for weeks on this.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and co-author with Chris Slazinger of Let the Flames Begin. You can get their recipe for balsamic braised pot roast on the website, splendidtable.org. And once you've got John's recipe, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, there's a new recipe for a quick weeknight supper. There are tips on techniques and what's good in the market. And best of all, it is free. Register on the site, splendidtable.org. Coming up, France's most notorious city, Sweet Almond's sinister sister, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, SuperTarget features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the SuperTarget nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. Now we're going to take you to France, to her most notorious city and her greatest seaport, Marseille. Now, this has been the town the French have most loved to hate, telling you it isn't really French. It's a heathen polyglot. But times are changing, and an American is chronicling that change. He is Daniel Young, author of Made in Marseille, Food and Flavors from France's Mediterranean Seaport. Daniel, welcome.
Oh, Lynn, it's great to be back.
You know, Daniel, I always think of Marseille as the city that doesn't get any respect, at least from the French. I mean, is that still true?
It's still true, and particularly from the Parisians. Of course, Parisian snobbery, or being the target of Parisian snobbery, is not unique to Marseille, but Marseille has certainly bore the brunt of it for at least 200-300 years.
Why is that?
Well, they're considered a world apart. Marseille is considered not French. It's a city of immigrants, of Mediterranean peoples. They speak with an accent. They talk with their hands, working class, seafaring people. And so the Parisians see them as being not French or being of another nationality or another type.
But you mentioned this is changing at this point. What's happening now?
Marseille isn't changing. It's the perception of Marseille and the whole idea of fusion cuisine, fusion culture, immigrant world culture. The rest of the world and the rest of France has caught up with Marseille. Now the filmmakers, the designers, the chefs, they're discovering Marseille. And it's pretty odd for the Marseille themselves, the people of Marseille, because to them, nothing's changed. It's been a city of immigrants for 2,600 years.
What does it feel like to be a traveler coming to Marseille?
Well, it's interesting because in the 19th century, the great travelers like Mark Twain and Alexander Dumas, when they arrived in Marseille, they had the feeling of already being in a foreign land, an exotic land, not part of France, not part of Europe. And today, when you arrive in Marseille, you have the same impression. You see, you hear languages you've never heard before. There are people from sub-Saharan Africa, from the small island nation of Camor. They're Southeast Asians. They're all kinds of different dress and tropical fruit, and the markets have produce we've never seen before, dried fish and so forth. So it's this eternal exotic nature of Marseille. And that's the great thing about coming to Marseille now. And thank heavens it hasn't changed. There's still that sense of discovery, of mystery, of the unknown.
Well, let's talk about the food. Is there something that you could call a Marseille style of food?
Well, it's interesting because Marseille is part of Provence. And although we love Provence, the colors, the perfumes, the fresh herbs, the tomatoes, garlic, and so forth, from agricultural point of view, it's actually a very impoverished region. It's dry and arid. What's perfect for herbs is not very good for raising livestock. So Provençal cuisine and Marseille cuisine has always, if you think of it as a wardrobe, it's been a narrow wardrobe with perhaps one or two main ingredients, say a little black dress, and then four or five dressers full of accessories. So Marseille cuisine is an accessory cuisine. And because it's a seaport, it's had the first coffee arrived in Europe through Marseille, the first exotic fruits or tropical fruits. So Marseille has always had an extraordinary capacity through its livelihood of shipping to embrace, to absorb flavors and spices. The spice trails all lead to Marseille. So it's a cuisine of accessories, of spices, of color.
So, I mean, are people eating regularly, the people of Marseille, are they eating the foods of all these immigrants?
Absolutely. They don't cook it as much in their homes. They'll cook their own cuisine in their homes, but they'll go out to restaurants to discover the other cuisines, or a lot of the young chefs are doing fusion cuisine. So they're wonderful Asian Mediterranean restaurants. There are places where you can get a couscous bouillabaisse, and of course, And also, for instance, a lot of the Comorans, these sub-Saharan Africans, work as cooks in the kitchen, as Vietnamese have done before them, and Egyptians, and Corsicans, Italians, and so forth. So eventually, their influence gets absorbed in the cuisine. There's a wonderful dish that's really pan-fried calamari in a garlic and parsley sauce. It's sort of a persillade, what they call. And all the locals assume that that's a Provençal or Italian dish.
Uh-huh.
But actually, it was introduced by a Vietnamese chef at a pizzeria who taught it to the Egyptian who replaced him, who taught it to a Camoran who replaced him, who gave me the recipe for my book, A New Yorker. So that's really the story of Marseille.
So, Daniel, tell me a couple of places that you'd want me to go and eat in.
Well, Lionel Levy, he has Une Table au Sud, and that's very creative cuisine. So I'd recommend you go there to really see the cutting edge of what's happening in Marseille. But more important than that even, there are seaside taverns, fish grills that you have in Marseille that you won't find anywhere else. And one of those places is called Le Tiboulin de Mer. And there you'll have the best fish you've ever had in your life, fish from waters perhaps within 5 miles of the restaurant. And you'll also get the fish stories, the great tales, the great folklore, the hanging around the table, drinking pastis, arguing about politics and the soccer team. You'll have the complete Marseille experience, and that's unique to Marseille.
What about neighborhoods? What neighborhoods should we visit?
Les Goudes, which is near Aimé's restaurant, is an old fishing village. And pretty much from that coastline, you see the antique Marseille, the same Marseille that the Greeks encountered 600 years B.C. So definitely you want to go to those old fishing villages near the Calanque, the wonderful rocky, savage inlets along the coast. And then in inner Marseille, you have the wonderfully mysterious Casbahs, I call them, these neighborhoods of, you never know what awaits you. They're steep alleyways and stairways, narrow lanes, and houses that sort of lean against each other to keep from blowing over. And that's kind of, for me, the Marseille of the Count of Monte Cristo or the Humphrey Bogart movies. And the Panier is the typical neighborhood of that sort. It's a medieval neighborhood, and it's adventurous, great cafes and hangouts. And you never know what awaits you.
Well, Daniel Young, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Daniel Young is author of Made in Marseille. He is also restaurant critic for New York City's Daily News newspaper. Find his recipe for Chez Etienne's pan-fried calamari with garlic and parsley on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, if you dig into old Mediterranean recipes, an unusual sounding ingredient often comes up, bitter almonds. Well, Fruit Authority David Karp has been researching them. He writes for national publications like the New York Times. David, welcome.
Well, it's good to be back, Lynn.
So, David, what got you interested in bitter almonds?
Well, I was sort of intrigued by the nut's sinister reputation, which is spread by the mystery tales in which a detective sniffed the odor of bitter almonds on a cyanide victim's breath.
So this is the sinister side of the innocent almond.
Exactly.
But what exactly is a bitter almond?
Well, you wouldn't know it's any different from a regular sweet almond from looking at it, but it contains a substance, amygdalin, which in the presence of water, or saliva for that matter, splits into two different substances. One is edible benzaldehyde, which provides an intense almond aroma and flavor, such as you would get from really good marzipan. And the other is deadly hydrocyanic acid, a fast-acting inhibitor of the respiratory system and deadly poison.
Are they deadly?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what the lethal dose would be, but scientists have estimated anywhere from 10 to 70 for an average-sized human.
So what's the lure here? I mean, why use these things if they're deadly?
Well, they've traditionally been used in Europe to add flavor to almond products such as almond paste, marzipan, almond milk, and various dishes. Chefs here in the United States are crazy for them. For example, my friend Tim Woods of Echo Restaurant in Fresno uses them for a bitter almond bread pudding that was just so delicious. It's the perfect foil to the richness of bread pudding. Kim Boyce of Campanile Restaurant uses the nuts to flavor panna cotta and ice cream. Junie Rogers of Zuni Cafe in Berkeley also.
But David, then are these dishes dangerous for people to eat?
No, the poison actually disperses in the presence of heat. So if they're cooked properly in any of the recipes, they're perfectly safe to eat. They also use just a few nuts, so they should be perfectly safe to use as used by a professional.
So where are they getting these? I mean, can you find this in the United States?
Unless you live in California, probably not. They're sold at a few farmers markets, like Rusty Hall of Paso Robles sells them at the Santa Monica Farmers Market from time to time. I've seen them for sale at the Monterey Market in Berkeley. But for the most part, unless you live in California, you can't get them. Why is that? California has a different legal situation for bitter almonds than the rest of the United States. The state's government allows them to be sold as long as they're properly labeled, saying that they need to be heated and should not be consumed fresh. Whereas in the rest of the United States, the FDA actually frowns upon their sale and would, as their bureaucratic language says, they would take appropriate action if they were to find them for sale anywhere. They would probably seize the nuts, possibly sanction somebody who was selling them. However, it's perfectly legal to sell them to chefs. So if you were to ship them, say, to an almond paste manufacturer from California to Washington or something like that, that would be just fine.
Uh-huh.
And you can bring them in. That's perfectly legal to buy them in Europe, and you can bring them in for your own personal use as long as they're shelled nuts into the United States. There's no problem taking them on the plane.
So you're saying that the flavor of a bitter almond is really kind of essential in certain kinds of dishes.
And marzipan especially, yes.
Okay. So, David, is there any other way for us to get the flavor of bitter almonds?
Yes. If you buy almond extract in the supermarket or wherever, that actually contains something called oil of bitter almond, at least if it's so-called pure almond extract.
Uh-huh.
That's made, ironically enough, oil of bitter almond, which is the main ingredient in pure almond extract, actually doesn't contain anything, for the most part, from bitter almonds themselves, but from the stones of closely allied fruits like peaches, apricots, nectarines, cherries, plums. Then there's another form, actually, called, this is very tricky, natural almond extract is actually made from cassia bark, which is closely related to cinnamon. And then finally, there's the synthetic, the imitation so-called almond extract, which is actually made from synthetic benzaldehyde, which is derived from petroleum extracts. Even though that's much cheaper, the other two forms, particularly the pure, have much rounder, more intense, better flavor.
So we can use pure almond extract, and that's safe and it's okay?
That's correct.
All right. And if we run across a bitter almond, we have to remember we have to cook it, and we don't use a lot of it.
Exactly.
David?
I like to nibble on them myself occasionally. And sometimes when I'm on the treadmill at the gym, I say to myself, am I getting old or is it the bitter almonds?
David, I'll let you walk on the wild side. I'm going to play it safe. Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
David Karp is known as the Fruit Detective. His article on bitter almonds appeared in the Los Angeles Times in February of 2002. Today, the word parent conjures up images of a man or woman pushing a toddler on a swing while talking on a cell phone and writing a PowerPoint presentation on their laptop simultaneously. Parenting is relentless, and even the most seemingly benign responsibility can send the most organized, thoughtful adult into a tailspin.
When my little daughter headed off to preschool, I worried about a lot of things. Would she miss me? Would she fall in with the wrong crowd? My biggest worry turned out to be something I hadn't even thought about, preschool snack. Once a month, every kid's parents must bring snack to 30 hungry three-year-olds, school rules. I had neurotic visions of having to make 30 individual fruit smiley faces. If I'm going to put that much work into food, I want something to show for my trouble, a perfect gumbo roux, flaky spanakopita, lobster bisque. The school has a series of snack rules. You have to bring a protein and a carb, no artificial ingredients, nothing sugary. I'm thinking, a protein and a carb, a protein and a carb, bagels and lox, beans and rice? I sought advice from a pro, a coworker who has three kids. Just bring pudding pop, she said. I can't. No artificial ingredients. It has to be a protein and a carb. Plus, there's a list posted. Mason, Sebastian, and Hannah are vegetarians. Haley and Nicholas don't eat dairy. No peanut butter for Zach or Othello. I hear it's even worse in other places. In some schools, you aren't allowed to bring anything homemade because of the dreaded liability concerns. Please, in a world like this, do we actually have the energy to worry about food poisoning from cupcake frosting? Do they have liability insurance for the nasty lunches in public school cafeterias where ketchup is a vegetable? My first turn as snack mom came in December 2000. That day may be inconsequential to the rest of you, but I'm a news reporter in Tallahassee, Florida, and we hadn't picked a president yet. I was slogging through another 14-hour day when it hit me. I was snack mom the very next day. I'd consumed nothing but vending machine food, takeout pizza, and stiff drinks since election day, and now I was supposed to morph into snack mom overnight? I staggered home at 11:30 p.m. My roommate, a maitre d' at a French restaurant, was just coming home. "I'm snack mom," I wailed. We went to the refrigerator. Miraculously, there were two blocks of supermarket cheese in the crisper. One, unfortunately, was jalapeno. I pulled out the mild cheddar. We had a box of Wheat Thins, not too stale. My roommate and I went out to the porch, where we obsessively smoked cigarettes. Hey, we all started smoking again during the 2000 election. We smoked, and we sliced cheese. "Smoke cheese," he joked. It was pitiful. My debut as snack mom, and I was bringing a tray of store-bought crackers and thin slices of cheese. "Hope you're not hungry, kids, and as for you lactose-intolerant sweeties, have a cracker." I slunk into preschool the next morning on my way to the Jesse Jackson rally. I carried in the tray. "Sorry," I said to the teacher. She smiled patiently. "Next time, maybe you could bring macaroni and cheese?" I smiled back. "Of course, a protein and a carb, and a warm one for little growing bodies." Back in the car, though, I started to worry. Did she mean macaroni and cheese from a box or homemade?
Julie Hauserman is Capitol reporter in Tallahassee, Florida for the St. Petersburg Times. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, how are church windows and wine related? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be getting to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how are church windows and wine related? Well, church windows is the name the Germans give to the rivulets of wine that run down the inside of the glass after you swirl the wine. Now, here in England, we call them legs. Now, supposedly, the more distinctive the legs, the better the wine. But Master of Wine Karen McNeil, in her book The Wine Bible, says no. According to her, legs have nothing to do with quality. But appearance can tell you a lot about a wine. First, always look at a wine against a white backdrop, for instance, a white paper napkin. Now, McNeil says color intensity has nothing to do with flavor intensity, but color can tell you which grape the wine was made from. For instance, Pinot Noir is a light vermilion, Gamay is cherry jello red, and Zinfandel can be electric purple. Now, then there is how color reveals age. With age, a white wine gets darker, but a red wine gets lighter. Think about this. All the information that you can gather before you even sip the wine. No wonder people obsess over this stuff.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Sarah on the line. Sarah, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about farro.
Oh, where did you run across farro?
I was having lunch with a friend at a restaurant here in Minneapolis, and it was a side dish. It was prepared with capers and Kalamata olives and chopped tomatoes. It was delicious, but I had never heard of it. I don't know what it is. I don't know where to find it, and I don't know how to prepare it.
So you want the basic primer on farro?
Yes, I do.
All right. Guys, this is what farro is. It is a form of wheat. It's from Italy. It's one of the three original wheats. We're going back 10,000 whatever years ago. If you translate farro into English, it's emmer, E-M-M-E-R. It comes either lightly crushed, so it just looks like little fragments, or it comes as something that looks like a wheat grain.
Okay.
And the best way to prepare it is you boil it.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, I find that it comes from different parts of Italy, and depending on where it's grown, it takes longer or shorter time to cook.
Is it like barley long or shorter than that?
No, I would say a little shorter than barley long. I'd say 40 minutes.
Okay.
Okay, but if it comes from another part of Italy, it might be an hour and a half.
I see.
And the trick here is cook it ahead.
Yeah.
And then you can rewarm it. And anything that you can do with pasta, from serving it at room temperature with, you know, chopped fresh raw vegetables, et cetera, like a salad, mm-hmm. to serving it hot with a sauce, you can do with farro. And you can also make a risotto with it.
Oh.
But what I do is, because you don't know how long it's going to take to cook, it depends on the source, what I do is take it to the point where it's almost done, and then I follow a normal risotto recipe.
Okay.
Hey.
Thanks a lot.
Go out and enjoy. It's real healthy.
I will.
Right.
All right.
800-537-5252, and we've got Amy calling. So, Amy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I was hoping you could help me with my new crock pot. Yeah. Really love the idea of something cooking while I'm at work, but I open the recipe books, and it seems like cream of mushroom soup is everywhere.
They have an arrangement with Campbell's, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, basically, I mean, have you ever used one before?
Yeah, I've played around a little bit, and I've overcooked my chicken a little, and I've had wine with the cream of mushroom soup, and that dresses it up some.
Yeah, but I know what you mean. I guess the basic idea is that anything that's a stew or a long cooking soup,
okay. You
can do in a crock pot. You know, so if you flip through cookbooks and you see recipes for beef and wine sauce or, you know, something like a long cooked chicken soup, you just do the first steps of the recipe, which would be browning perhaps or mixing ingredients and sauteing them. And then you bring them to a simmer and then you put them in your crock pot.
Okay.
So the idea is pick any recipe that appeals to you that is a stew or a long cooked soup or a pot roast. for instance, and do it in the crock pot, but get it really hot before it goes in.
Oh.
Because the only thing I'm always hesitant about with a crock pot is that if you put things in that are stone cold, you know, you start it raw, sort of, what happens is it takes a long time for the inside of the meat, especially, because it's the protein that usually can cause the problem I'm going to talk about, to get hot. And you can have some negative bacteria form. That's a nice way of putting it, which causes tummy aches and other problems after dinner. So if you get that really hot and you get all the liquid around it bubbling and then you put it into the crock pot and get it up to a gentle simmer, you're usually home free and you're pretty safe.
How do you figure out how many hours at that point?
Well, I think that the key is that if the recipe says cook this for an hour and a half, in the crock pot it may take 2.5 or 3. But it's not going to necessarily go all day. It depends on the toughness of the meat. Like, for instance, if I were doing, oh, let's say, really chewy stew, you know, I'd bought stew meat, beef stew meat, I would let that go for 5 or 6 hours because a crock pot cooks it so slowly. But if I were doing a whole chicken, you know, like buying just a normal roasting or a fryer and putting it in, as you said, you overcook the chicken. 4 or 5 hours would have a lot of very good sauce around a chicken that would have no taste left in it because it would be overcooked. So in the case of that chicken, 1.5 hours, maybe 2 hours.
Okay.
Yeah. But the great thing that I think it works for are these long cooked soups where you have chunks of meat in it, and you have lots of vegetables and lots of interesting seasonings, and you've added water and you get that all up to a boil, you put it in the crock pot and you go to work. And when you come home at night, you put that over rice or over pasta or over couscous, and it's just out of this world. And, you know, you can freeze it, you can do all kinds of other things to it. You could even add cream of chicken soup or cream of mushroom soup to it if you wanted. But, you know, the idea is that that becomes the basic dish that you can then throw other things into.
Right.
And that's where the crock pot really shines.
Great.
It's a fun toy, and it's handy.
Yeah, it is. And do you have a recommendation of a recipe book that has a lot of stews?
You know what occurs to me, and I'm not sure if it's still out new, but you could probably find it on Half.com or Amazon, you know, places that sell used stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, there was a book by Fred Griffith and his wife, whose name now escapes me. It's called Cooking Undercover, and it's all about stewing and braising. And it would be just the kind of recipes that would be dynamite for a crock pot. Cooking Undercover. And I know it's going to be around. And it's not going to cost you a lot of money.
That'll be a fun exploration.
Yeah.
I can be a little more sophisticated then.
Well, yes. And not only that, but once you get on someplace like Half.com, who knows what you may find. Hey, have a good time with it.
Thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You can reach us 800-537-5252. We've got Andrew calling. Andrew, thanks for being so patient. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. First, I want to say that I really love your show. I'm definitely someone who loves to eat.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
I'm just now getting into cooking sort of on my own, and I am looking for a book that would really sort of explore kind of the basics of cooking. Not necessarily a cookbook with, you know, a lot of recipes in it,
yeah,
but almost something that would take a kind of theoretical approach to sort of the basic way that flavors and spices and ingredients work together.
Mm.
You know, I like, for example, you know, sort of what is sage? You know, what would you use sage
right,
for
right,
and that kind of thing?
You know, so you're looking for a book that's going to give you the basics of how food works when you work in the kitchen.
Exactly.
And of course, I've drawn a complete blank on any single book that might do that. Are you up for hearing about a couple of them? Because a couple come to mind.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am.
Okay. When it comes to flavoring with herbs, there is a book called The Herb Farm Cookbook by Jerry Traunfeld.
Herb
Farm Cookbook. It came out about 2 years ago, I think. And what he has, aside from brilliant recipes, and a lot of them so simple, but when I say brilliant, this man has an original turn of mind that's great, and really simple things that you do that give you incredible payback in taste.
Okay.
But he has charts also. I mean, he has charts that say to you,
You use sage with, yeah, we know about pork, we know about this, we know about that, but did you know about the fact that sage might be wonderful in a creme brulee? I'm making that up, but
yeah.
But and the book is so clearly written that for ideas for seasoning with herbs of any kind and even some flowers like lavender, you know, and that kind of thing.
Oh, wow, that sounds great.
I just think it's indispensable. I'm hesitating because one that comes to mind is one that is based on classical French techniques, but it is pictures. And if you ever want to know how to fillet a fish, you know, if you ever want to know what it means to dice, and also things that are more esoteric than that, Jacques Pepin, P-E-P-I-N.
Okay.
You've seen, if you've ever watched PBS food shows, you have definitely seen Jacques Pepin. He's French. He often cooks with his daughter Claudine, and he's a master chef. He had done two books, one called La Méthode, the method, the other one called La Technique, the technique. They were two big picture books, but now they've been put together in a paperback. And
okay.
It's something like Complete Techniques. But if it's Jacques Pepin, it's a big, thick paperback, and I think it's called Complete Techniques. Thumb through that, because what I love is that it's pictures. So he shows you, you know, when the recipe tells you to do this, this is what it's about. This is what a sauté is. This is what a braise is.
Yeah, now, that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Right. There's no recipes in the book. It's all technique and method. The other one is Deborah Madison.
Deborah Madison.
Yeah. And it is Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. That's the name of the book. And the great thing about that book is that although, again, it's a book of recipes, it is full of definitions and information.
That's fantastic. Actually, my girlfriend eats a lot of vegetarian stuff, so that'll go over really well, I think.
And by the way, the first cookbook I mentioned also, the Herb Farm Cookbook, is going to have a lot of things she's going to like.
That's great.
And now
that's
to put you into complete overload, all right?
Okay.
One,
that's fine.
Yeah, one book on science that I think beats them all out, on kitchen science, because it's written by a woman who's not only a scientist, but she's an incredible cook.
Uh-huh.
It's called Cook Wise, one word, by Shirley Currier. Yeah, I think it's C-O-R-R-I-H-E-R. And I think almost all of them are still in print, but I always go to the bargain places to try to find these books first.
That's probably a good place to look for them. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I'm going to be looking for these very soon.
We've given you a library, Andrew. You're now going to be the king of the kitchen.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for.
Hey, thanks a lot.
I appreciate it.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You know, I want to take a minute to look at how food, art, and moral issues can intersect. This might be uncomfortable for some of our listeners. There was an art exhibition, a rather unusual one, about food in the Napa Valley at Copia, which is the New American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts. The exhibition was called The Last Supper. It was about death row prisoners. The artist is Julie Green. Now we have Julie on the phone. Julie, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Julie, what was this Last Supper exhibition?
It's an exhibition of 154 mineral painted plates. It's also called China Painting, which document final meal requests of inmates on death row in the United States.
What moved you to do this?
Well, I used to live in Oklahoma, and in the newspaper, in the morning paper, they would print, when people were executed, then they would print facts about the execution and what the inmate had for their last meal. And I was very surprised to find that in the paper. And I think sometimes we make art to process information, and I began to collect those menus and do drawings of them. And then that led into the process of, I tried embroidery on placemats and different ways of illustrating the plates. And then I hit on the idea of painting on actual plates. And that's where the idea came from.
So you've actually painted the food on the plate.
Right, right.
Did you actually work with the prisoners?
I did not work with the prisoners. The menus were provided in the newspaper, and I just started with Oklahoma, and then I went on to Texas and got the information from the websites. So I did not ever work with the prisoners.
So strange that they would do that.
Yeah, I thought it said something about the culture. I'm not sure what. And I guess I had questions about the death penalty and the prison system and the margin for error. And so I think it just seemed like a timely piece to encourage debate, and there certainly was a lot of debate.
Julie, what were some of the menus?
Well, there was a lot of diner food, a great deal of chicken burgers, things like that. One that stood out for me was a Texas menu that was one bag of assorted Jolly Ranchers. And probably the most poignant menu that I saw was an Indiana menu from 2001, which is German ravioli and chicken dumplings prepared by his mother and prison dietary staff.
Ooh.
Yeah.
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 So tell me, when people see this exhibition, how do they react?
Well, this is the fourth time. It showed at Copia and just came down. Before that, it showed for the first time in England, and that was an interesting venue because I thought that the conversations might be like, oh, there's so many guns in the U.S. or, you know, something about the death penalty. But actually, the British population, the viewers talked about, like, what is a chicken fried steak and what's gumbo? And the questions were very food, wondering about what these American Southern dishes particularly were.
Huh.
And then when I showed it at Copia, actually, there's a comment book, and there's almost 300 comments from the exhibition, and they go back and forth from being very positive to very negative. I actually have the book here. I tagged a few. If you'd like, I could read a couple comments.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. I'll start with positive. Let's see. This is a very powerful exhibit that helps us realize how much food defines who we are as people, down to the very last second. Thank you. And this is the reason the world needs artists. Everyone's eyes are opened by a different approach. Very moving. Thank you. And then one, let's see, go back to Oregon, you stinky hippie. really, the full spectrum of response is very positive and kind of mean-spirited, too.
So, Julie, what are you working on now? What's next?
I have the plates in my studio now, and I'm making a video where I hold up each painted plate. They're all blue on white porcelain, and I read the menu out loud. And so this is a component that will be for future exhibitions or maybe separate from the installation. And I consider it a work in progress, so I actually have several hundred additional menus in my studio, and I'll continue painting.
Well, Julie Green, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Artist Julie Green is assistant professor of art at Oregon State University. Her work, The Last Supper, was exhibited at Copia, the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this from the late Irma Bombeck. In general, my children refused to eat anything that hadn't danced on TV. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. And by the way, don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.